Let's continue in our analysis of the characteristics of the ARM processor by looking at the example of code shown in the slide 64. This code is very simple and implements the calculation of a FIR filter. You see the C code, the high-level code, that is basically a for cycle that iterates over a couple of integer indexes I and F. The termination condition is I less than a suitable integer number, and I is incremented. One is the quantity of which it is incremented, and you see that the filtering consists into the accumulation of the multiplication of each input considered element x of I by a suitable coefficient corresponding to the same position c of I in an array that probably contains different coefficients for every one of the samples that are acquired. Translating this very simple and immediate code into the assembly code that we want to analyze, we have to move 0 in two registers that will correspond to scratch variables. We identify the register R2 just to contain the address of n, and then we go to the memory at that address to load that value in the register R1. Then we set to 0 R2 because with R2 now we indicate the value of the variable f that is accumulated at every iteration of the code. And in the slide 65, we have first the loading of the two addresses of the array C and of the array X in the two registers R3 and R5. Then we start with the loop, the body of each iteration. First of all, we need to load the ith element of the array C and of the array X. So we consider the address that is stored in R3. We add to it the index that is stored in the register R8, and the location of memory addressed by that quantity is read, and the content is put in the register R4. Therefore, R4 contains C of I. The same approach is followed for the array X. So R5 contains the base address of X. R8 is again the I index. So we calculate R5 plus R8, and the memory location pointed by that value is addressed, and its content is loaded in R6. The next step is the multiplication of R4 times R6, that is the multiplication of the value of C times X. The result is stored in R4, and then it is accumulated in the register R2 that has been previously set to 0 in slide 64, and now is ready to contain the accumulation of the sum of every couple CI times XI. Next step is to add 4 to R8. We start from the hypothesis that the values that we are considering are integer. So the next location in to the array is reached not by adding to the index 1, but adding to the index 4, because the data are 32-bit wide. And R0 instead is incremented by 1, because in R0 we are considering the real index, not the offset that we must use for achieving the correct memory location. R0 is compared with R1 because the R1 contains n, that is the number of the elements of the array that we want to filter, that is, we want to multiply by the proper coefficients. And if this value is has not reached, that is branch less than, we continue to loop. Otherwise, of course, we exit from such a kind of very simple calculation. In slide 66, we find again an old concept that we have seen in the last lesson, that is how to call a routine, simply executing the instruction BL, branch and link, followed by a suitable label, that is a sequence of alphanumeric characters that correspond to the address of the routine we want to begin to execute. The branch and link instruction jumps to the desired location, that is, stores the label, the address that corresponds to that label, into the program counter. But before doing it, it copies the current program counter to the link register, the R14 register, to facilitate the return from the routine that has been called and executed back to the main code. And when we say current PC, we mean not the PC of the calling instruction, but the PC of the instruction immediately following, so as we copy in R14 PC plus 4. Let's remember that the automatic increment of the program counter to the next instruction is typically done during the fetch phase of, let's say, the access to the memory for fetching the instruction that must be executed. This is a typical characteristic of many microprocessors, ARM family included. When we have finished the subroutine that we want to execute, the so-called return instruction, that is the instruction that will allow to us to go back to the program that called that subroutine, is move R14, that is copy the return link register content into the program counter, just to continue the normal execution. In the case that the subroutine that we want to call is characterized by nesting, that is, the subroutine in turn calls another subroutine, or perhaps itself, we have to use the stack area and the stack pointer to pass the necessary parameters to the subroutine for the correct execution. This issue is presented in slide 67 in a very, let's say, elementary way, just to depict the main ideas. In this slide, you see an imaginary subroutine called F1 that makes use of the register R13, that is the stack pointer, used to point a suitable area, the stack area. Therefore, the first instruction that we use, that is implemented, is a load register R0, the memory location pointed addressed by R13. In other words, the stack area containing a parameter that must be received from the main program calling this subroutine is used, and the value is charged in the register R0. In our hypothesis, this is the only argument that the main program under the subroutine exchange. Therefore, the other thing that we have to do is, in the case like this, the subroutine calls another function. This function is the F2, and you clearly see that this happens because in the middle of the code you see the instruction BL, branch and link F2. We need to store into the stack area the same magnitudes, the same quantities that have been saved by the main program when it called F1, just to keep the execution of the sequence of subroutines correct, to know where to come back when we exit from the subroutine F2, and to, let's say, make the content of the registers that are used by these subroutines congruent. For achieving this task, the first instruction is a store in the memory area addressed by R13 of the content of the register R14. And we remember that R14 contains the back, the return address that we wrote in the main program when we called the routine F1. Clearly, this address must be saved in a certain part of the memory. Otherwise, when we execute the branch and link instruction, we will overwrite it, losing the possibility of returning from the present subroutine, the F1 subroutine. The second quantity that is saved in the stack area is the register R0, because even in this case, we have to pass to the subroutine F2 the argument that it needs for the correct elaboration. Again, therefore, we have a store instruction of R0 in the memory area pointed by R13, the stack pointer. Both the arguments, both the quantities, the return address and the argument have been saved in the stack area just to be read and used by the function BLF2, by the function F2 that is going to be executed. Notice that in the two instructions we have an exclamation point. You remember that the exclamation point means that we apply an auto increment of the index of the address better of the memory location that we are pointing. Probably in this case the best the correct word to identify this procedure is to say auto upgrading, because the upgrading of the stack pointer can consist in an increment or in a decrement depending on the particular stack that we are considering, and if we are let's say upgrading the stack pointer towards the growing addresses or the diminishing addressing. And moreover, it depends on the fact that the stack area that we are addressing is an area into which the stack pointer points the last written location or the first empty location. As you can understand, the ARM family features the possibility of having different stack areas and therefore different stack pointers. We will see more details in the next slide, in the continuation of the lesson. For now, let's say we are only happy since we know that the exclamation point means the stack pointer is upgraded in the correct way without specifying how. The general concept now is we have saved the right thing in the stack area. Now we call the function F2. We execute that code, we do anything, and now we come back. So we jump at the end of F2 exactly at the sub R13 for instruction. Why this? Because the last operation that we have done onto the stack pointer is the auto upgrading due to the fact that the stack pointer addressed a memory area into which we passed the argument R0. The argument R0 is the argument that we used in the function F2, but is no more useful, so we have no motivation to recover it, because now it's over. The routine has been concluded. Therefore, we can, let's say, abandon it. From the point of view of the stack pointer management, this means to upgrade the stack pointer to the next location that we need to recover. And this location is the area, the memory area, that contains the back return address, the location into which we saved the R14 register, because that register contained the address of the instruction in the main program immediately following the call instruction, the call F1 instruction. Therefore, R13 now will point that location, and when we execute the last instruction, load register R15, the content of R14, basically we are loading in the R15 in the program counter the content of the back instruction, that is we perform the jump back from F1 to the main program into which we have to continue the normal execution. Look at the presence of the exclamation point, that means that since even this location of the stack is no more useful, the R14 stack pointer must be upgraded just to leave also that location, as it would be emptied. Concretely, it is, let's say, no more considered, and for the next programming duties, it will be considered free. That is, it can be written as the need of the program will require. The slide 68 shows indeed the possible four types of stack that can be managed in the ARM processor family. We have a full ascending, empty descending, and full descending type of stacks, depending on the fact that the stack pointer addresses the last written location of the stack area, or the first empty one, and depending on the fact that the upgrade of the stack pointer is made towards low addresses or high addresses. For example, let's consider the first column that is named full ascending. In this case, the stack pointer points that gray rectangle, that is the last filled memory location, the last filled stack location. So this justifies the name full. And since the top of the memory that is represented by that column corresponds to low addresses, and the bottom corresponds to high addresses. When we write the first word, the first variable into the stack area, we will need first to increment the stack pointer, just to address the next empty location, and then to write the variable that we need to save. But clearly, we need to increment the stack pointer, because the next free location is at addresses higher than the previous one. Let's continue in this explanation, and let's consider the second column called EA, that is empty ascending. Here you see that the stack pointer corresponds to the first location, white in the picture, that is to the first empty location. Therefore, the name empty and ascending, because at this point we will need only to write to store the variable in the memory location to which we are interested, but we need also to increment again the stack pointer to address the next free location that will be ready for the next eventual operation. Let's consider the third column. In this case, we talk about empty descending. The stack pointer now points again a white, an empty location. So we will write that location with the variable that we need to save. But now, just to point to the next free location for the next saving, we have to decrement the stack pointer, because we see that the free, let's say, memory is corresponding to the low addresses. And finally, the fourth column, full descending, into which the stack pointer points again the last written memory location. And if we wanted to save something, we have before to decrement the stack pointer, just to find the next free memory location into which write the variable that we want to save, and then to store effectively it. So we have four possibilities: full ascending, empty ascending, empty descending, full descending. Four characteristics that allow the family to be very flexible with the several philosophies of codes that have been followed in the past, so as to help the portability of the code also in this kind of processors. The slide 69 provides us another information. Till now we have seen that the stack area can be addressed by the usual load and store registers that we have learned to use several times. Now we see that other two operations can be performed onto the stack area that are defined through the acronyms LDM and STM. They correspond to multiple loads and multiple stores. In other words, it is possible to perform with a single unique instruction the loading and the storing of many registers in the stack area. And depending on the particular type of stack that we are considering, we will have a different mode for addressing the location and for incrementing or decrementing the stack pointer. For example, let's consider the load operation. That is, basically we have to read the content of the stack area, putting it into a suitable register. If the stack is full descending, this means that we need to increment the stack pointer after the usage of it. In fact, if we read a full descending stack, this means that the stack pointer is already located on the right position, so we read the content of that position, and then since we want to empty the memory, we have to go in the opposite direction to the one that is characterizing the stack. The stack is descending. To empty a memory location, we have to increment the stack pointer. If we perform a load on an empty descending stack area, we have to increment, but before, because if the pointer points the empty location and we want to read something, we have to come to go back to the last field location, and therefore we have to increment the stack pointer, since the direction into which the stack pointer is upgraded is towards the low addresses. Load multiple registers in case of full ascending stack. Perfect. In this case, this means that we have to read a memory location that is already pointed by the stack pointer, full, and therefore we read that location, then we empty it. That is, we upgrade the stack pointer in the opposite direction into which typically we go if we want to find the next free location. That is, since the stack is ascending, we have to decrement the stack pointer. And finally, empty ascending, we have to decrement before the stack pointer, because this means that we are addressing the new empty location, but we need to read. So we have to decrement the stack pointer because the stack goes towards the high addresses, and then we can read the memory location into which we are interested, and that's all, because at this point that memory is emptied. The same considerations can be done for the operation of storing, therefore I don't want to repeat, because they are exactly similar to the one that we did about the load operation. In the following slide, we have a few examples of how the instructions can be written. For example, we have a store multiple register, considering R14, of course, and look at the way into which the registers are written, are identified. That is a list between two parentheses, R0, R7. This means that we store into a memory stack area that is increment after. You see clearly the postfix to the instruction. So looking at the table, we find that this kind of stack is empty ascending. We write R0 in the first location, R1 in the second one, R2 in the third one, and more and more and more up to the last, that is R7. But look, we don't have any exclamation point in such a syntax, therefore R13 remains as it is, without upgrading. Instead, if we consider the next one, load multiple registers on the memory area pointed by R14 with the exclamation point, so this time we will upgrade the stack pointer, and you have a list that specifies a single register, R1, separated by the list of the remaining ones by a comma. So we have to write, to load, to read R1, R4, and R5. R1 is read with the content of the memory location pointed by R13. R4 with the stack content in R14 plus 4, and R5 with the stack content of the location R13 plus 8. But look, at the end of these operations, we perform the upgrading of R13, that is R14 equal to R14 plus 12. Right, because we have read three registers, that is 12 bytes, so we have to upgrade, in this case, increment the stack pointer, because the particular type of stack that we are considering is full descending, of the same amount of the bytes that we have read, that is 12. And finally, in the slide 71, we have, let's say, a picture, a representation of how the registers are, let's say, written in the stack area, depending on the four possible types of stack that we can consider. The first one is the full descending, so we want to write R0, R1, R3, R4 and R5. Okay, that is from R0 to R5 except R2. Perfect. Full descending, therefore this means that we every time point the last written memory location. So first of all we have to modify the stack pointer and then to write. In this case the stack is descending, so we need to decrement before and then write. Okay, look at the fact that the first register in the list will be always the one that is on the top of the stack. So we write R5, then R4, then R3, then R1, and finally R0. And the final stack pointer, look at the fact that we have the exclamation point, will point exactly to the memory location that contains R0. The same philosophy is followed if we consider an empty descending stack area. That is, also in this case, the direction into which we upgrade the stack pointer is towards the low addresses. Also in this case, we write R5, R4, R3, R1, R0. Since the stack pointer and the stack are called empty descending, this means that after the operations, the stack pointer will address the first free memory location. But again, R0, the first register in the list, will be close to the, let's say, top of the stack, that is, to the point into which the stack pointer is physically located, that is, the first free cell. Conversely, considering two stacks into which the direction of the upgrading of the stack pointer is towards the high addresses, we have to write the instruction store multiple full address and store multiple empty address. The considerations are equal as before. In the first case, the stack pointer addresses the last written location, so we have to increment in this case, because we are going towards high addresses, and then to write the suitable content of the register that we are considering. But in this case, the philosophy is the opposite, that is, the first register that is written is R0, then R1, then R3, then R4, and then R5. Full means that the stack pointer stops at the last location written, but differently than before, this location contains the register R5. And the same considerations can be done for the empty ascending stack. In this case, we start from the first free cell, that is filled with R0, then R1, then R3, then R4, then R5, and then we perform an increment after. That is, after writing the memory location with the content we want, we increment the stack pointer so as to point to the next free location. Content of the written location closest to this one is R5. So when the direction is towards high addresses, the last of the list that is written in the higher address, and the first of the list is written in the lower address. The same result is obtained when we go towards the descending addresses, but of course with operations that are exactly the reverse. But if you look at the picture, you have the same, let's say, distribution, the same list. R0 points always at the lowest address in the stack, and R5 points always at the last address in the stack itself.
Another important topic related to the ARM processor is the way through which the peripherals are programmed, the so-called I/O programming. Typically, in microprocessors, two types of instruction can support the I/O. Special purpose I/O instructions, typically called input and output ones, and memory mapped load store instruction, into which the approach is to consider the specific port or the specific peripheral as a memory location to which the usual instruction of reading and writing are employed, as this peripheral would be a normal memory cell without any particular specification. While the Intel family typically provides in and out instructions, that is equipped with specific instructions devoted to the I/O, many other CPUs use memory mapped I/O, and typically the ARM family belongs to this last category. For example, in the slide 73, we have a fragment of code into which the peripheral that we are considering, called Dev1, is associated with a memory address 1000 expressed in hexadecimal code. So this address is loaded normally into a register, and the access to that peripheral is made as that peripheral would be a memory cell. So load R0, R1 in brackets means read the port, read the device, load R0 8, and then store R0 in R1 between brackets corresponds to write a specific datum into that peripheral to maybe send out it to the external world. There is a specific way through which peripherals can communicate in a fast way with the main CPU, that is interrupt. We have seen in the previous sections of the course that typically ports and peripherals can be periodically monitored through the polling of their own status registers. But if we want that the event related to the peripheral change of state is immediately detected by the CPU, this is not the best, let's say, choice, but we could implement the interfacing between CPU and external device through an interrupt management. And the typical implementation, we have seen this in the case of the ports, serial and parallel of the Intel family in the previous section devoted to digital communication, is the so-called interrupt vectorization. This is an approach into which different devices can be handled by different pieces of code, and typically the CPU is equipped with a table that contains the so-called interrupt vector. In other words, starting from a specific address called interrupt vector table head, we have a set of many locations of memory. Each one contains the address of the handler 0, the handler 1, the handler 2, and the handler 3, and more and more and more, as shown in slide 74, where handler 0, for example, could be the address of the interrupt service routine for a parallel port request of service. The handler 1 corresponds to the routine for the serial port. The handler 2 corresponds to the routine for a timer device. And of course, we can imagine that we have several routines, because more than one could be the number of parallel and serial ports in the general architecture of the system. Slide 75 shows, and even in this case we have already described such a kind of situation, the interrupt vector acquisition. We have the CPU, and we have the device. When needed, the device raises up a signal that expresses a request for a service to the CPU. The CPU will receive such a kind of request and will provide to the device a suitable acknowledgement for this. You remember that in the case of the port that we have explained in the previous lessons, there was a specific interrupt line managed through a daisy chain by several external devices to the CPU, and the most higher in terms of priority was authorized to signal its own request on this line, and the answer of the CPU to that peripheral was the contemporaneous activation of the signal M1 and IO request. This combination was recognized by the hardware interface of the specific peripheral as acknowledgement of the request, and the successive step was the sharing of the vector handler by the specific peripheral that raised up the request with all the players connected to the data bus, but in particular with the CPU. The CPU, on the other hand, is monitoring that bus, and when finds a suitable value, takes that value as the address to which it is necessary to jump for reading that particular location and obtaining that address that must be loaded into the program counter so as to properly serve the interrupt request. We remember that the vector provided by the peripheral was typically provided to the peripheral itself during the configuration, and it is a task of the programmer to configure properly the address that the peripheral must receive, and to associate that address in the interrupt vector table to the correct routine address that must be executed and run. What we have said, let's say, by describing in words is shown in slide 76 through this yellow flowchart. We have the first step into which the CPU asks for an interrupt request arrived or not. If not, clearly the execution continues. If yes, the question is the interrupt received now priority is greater than the current priority of the tasks that are in execution. If yes, we expresses, we send to the peripheral an acknowledgement signal on the basis of which the peripheral will return the vector for the interrupt management. This must be done within a certain interval of time called timeout. In case of the expiration of such a kind of interval, the CPU will raise up a condition of bus error. Otherwise, the received vector will address the proper location, the proper position in the table devoted to the interrupt management, and therefore we will have the possibility of identifying the correct routine that must be run. Slide 77 summarizes, therefore, the interrupt sequence of the operations that must be performed. First of all, the CPU acknowledges the interrupt request, then the device sends the vector, then the CPU calls the proper handler, and the software that elaborates the interrupt request is executed. Finally, the CPU will restore the state to the foreground program. In doing this, we can have some sources of overhead. First of all, the handler, that is the routine devoted to the specific request, needs time to be executed. But there is also a overhead due to the interrupt mechanism that we have just now seen. In other words, we have the acknowledgement signal that must be sent from the CPU to the device, and then the time necessary for the device to give to the CPU the interrupt vector, and surely the time to raise up the signal connected to the interrupt line. All these components are very short. We are talking about nanoseconds, or in the worst case few microseconds, but in any case they represent an overhead, a time into which we don't perform any useful operation, but instead we are managing the particular interrupt request situation. Moreover, when serving an interrupt request, we abandon the present execution, so we have to save the registers that are currently in usage, and generally speaking, we have to save the context of the present elaboration. And of course, when the interrupt management will be finished, we will need to restore the same quantities. In the modern processors, moreover, we have penalties related to the pipeline and the caches mechanisms that in the normal execution allow to augment the throughput of instruction execution and the velocity with which data necessary to the elaboration are recovered. But in case we change completely the execution context, it is clear that pipelines and caches must be flushed, and this is time that is lost simply to prepare, let's say, the situation for the elaboration of the interrupt service routine.